Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Well, I want to give a wonderful, warm welcome to Charles Hill. He was raised in an evangelical home. After a four-year career with the Columbus, Ohio Police Department, he had an experience which led him to leave that career behind to enter full-time ministry. Charles and his wife started several successful churches, preached multiple times every weekend to locations around the world, and were well-known Christian conference speakers just before their theological worldview came crashing down. I'm sure many of us can relate to that. Following their deconversion, they lost income, family, friends, and community. He has been an RFR support group leader since 2014, as well as being a communications director and a board member for the Clergy Project. Charles and his wife, Tiffany, have been married for 25 years and have three amazing children. So Charles, please begin. And we'd love to hear what you have to say. And thank you very much for giving us this presentation.
You are welcome. It's great to be here tonight. I don't know if I'm an expert, but I will certainly do my best.
Well, Charles, what are you here to talk about? And kind of like let's do some of the bare bones stuff first.
So the Clergy Project. Yeah. I was trying to furiously, I didn't catch the final tally there from the poll, but it was interesting. 38% is what I had, and then it flashed off the screen on the final tally. 38% said yes, they have. 64% said no, they hadn't. And I'm really interested too in the second question, because it's something that a lot of people tend to not want to process or process through, because we were the pastor. So do you feel anger toward those religious leaders that taught and led you in your faith communities? And 23% said yes. And I validate that feeling. You are 1000% allowed to have that feeling. 23%, maybe not anger, but other emotions. 30% know they were doing what was passed down to them. And 5% haven't thought about it. So the Clergy Project is, what we're here to talk about tonight. And it has to do with those that were former professional, paid, or otherwise professional staff on a church. Maybe they were a missionary. Maybe they were a worship leader in a church. And they eventually realized that they no longer could believe. And so in order to be a member of the Clergy Project, you have to be a former professional paid staff person at a ministry, and B, no longer hold any supernatural beliefs at all. Go ahead.
So I kind of get the feeling that we'll be using pastor quite a bit in this conversation, but would this extend towards just about any religious leader, like a priest or a rabbi or a imam or something like that?
Absolutely. We do have priests. We have plenty of priests from the Catholic Church, imams. We have former Buddhists that are a part of it. Primarily though, the makeup of the Clergy Project is still focused in the United States. And it's the typical people that you think would be a pastor or maybe a youth pastor, a children's pastor. Mm. We do have a lot of missionaries too, that went to other countries.
Oh, wow. I hadn't considered that.
Yep.
Yeah. We, every now and then through the support group, we get emails from missionaries. I'm in Africa, in a country in Africa, and I have stopped believing. I don't know what to do. We direct them to the Clergy Project, but it's heart-wrenching for me to see that. Like, they're thousands of miles away from their home and not really in a place that they want to be, both mentally and physically.
Yeah, we've had several people over the years show up at our group, unbeknownst to me, and we've had several missionaries, probably three, maybe four. And yeah. They came to our RFR group. I don't want to be confusing here, because RFR is such a huge part of my life, as is the Clergy Project. And I really see them one and the same. So it's a good time to kind of delineate that like we did at the beginning. RFR is just a very wide, broad, if you are struggling with your faith, if you still might even be in it, if you were a former pastor or not. But the Clergy Project is really a very confidential, secretive. Mm-hmm. You have to work, you know, pretty hard to vet yourself to get in because of the confidentiality. Group that's focused in much the same way as RFR. But if you're still struggling, if you got one foot in and one foot out, you're not admitted to the Clergy Project yet. You need to be free of supernatural belief.
And you don't shake it all about.
No.
Got it. What's the mission statement for the Clergy Project?
Well, if you want the absolute formal mission statement of the Clergy Project, it is the mission of the Clergy Project is to provide support, community, and hope to current and former religious professionals without supernatural beliefs. So we do have a fairly large number of people that are still currently actively pastoring in a church, and they feel stuck. They don't know how to get out. And so they make contact with us, and we provide resources and game plans and things to help them transition out into another career. And then we've got plenty of people that were former pastors and clergy that join as well.
I'm not at all, or have never been a professional clergy member. So it would be kind of hard for me to understand, like, what would be different about a professional clergy? Like, I could imagine it would be mentally difficult to be coming up with a service every, or a preaching every Sunday and not really believing what you're saying. But is there more than just those kinds of things?
Yeah, it might be a good time for me to back up to just a little bit. Let me just give a tiny little history just so people know how it started. I think that would be important. Is that okay?
Perfect. Perfect.
I mean, it actually, if you really trace it back, it started in 1984 on the Oprah show when Dan Barker, many of you know Dan Barker, went on national TV and talked about leaving his faith behind. In 1992, he published a book, and let me see, I don't want to get this wrong, Losing Faith and Faith from Preacher to Atheist. So Dan, at that time, was leading Freedom from Religion Foundation. He published this book. Well, fast forward to 2006. Between those years of 1984 and 2006, Dan would start to meet all of these people that were in the ministry, or they were former clergy that had lost their faith, and they didn't realize that there was anybody else out there like them. Now, I can tell you that's very similar to RFR. We have people that show up at our support group every week, and they say, I didn't really know there was anything like this out there. So very much the same similar thing. These pastors would think that there was nobody else out there that would have ever deconverted. They didn't know who to talk to. They didn't know what to do. So he started keeping a database over 20 years of all of these people. And wow. From my understanding, he really didn't know what to do with it. Fast forward to 2006, some of you might know him. He's got a small following, Richard Dawkins, met up and was speaking at the same conference that Dan was in Iceland. And Richard Dawkins had just released The God Delusion. And he had heard about this, you know, Dan Barker guy and what he was doing. And he really had a desire to help. He really wanted to help some of these pastors make this transition. And so they had their first conversation in 2006. They met again in 2008. And Dawkins again pushed Dan and said, hey, how can I help? And so from 2008, they started really plotting this thing out. In 2011, in Washington, D.C., there was a nice group of people that met. At that time, Daniel Dennett was involved. I think many of you might know his name. And they just started dreaming of this place that pastors that felt trapped that were currently in the ministry or that formerly were in the ministry could get help. They actually kind of envisioned it as a halfway house. But what they came up with as this first step was an online forum where people could privately and secretly log in and be able to share many of those challenges specifically that clergy face that are kind of hiding in the pulpit, which was the name of Linda LaScola and Dan Dennett's, you know, groundbreaking work, where they actually looked and researched and did some very in-depth reporting on clergy that were stuck in the pulpit or had transitioned. Fast forward then, I mean, it's a really interesting story. You can go to clergyproject.org. I'm sure we'll mention that again and read the full story. But in March 20th of 2011, Dan Barker and several other people reached out to all of these people that they had in their database, the people that they had interviewed in the quantitative study, and 52 charter members were welcomed into the Clergy Project. And from there, there was an online forum where people could meet and talk, much like we do in our RFR meetings every week, about the struggles of what it takes to overcome, you know, losing your faith while still active in the clergy, or as a former clergy and still struggling with some of those things. So that's just a unique little background about how it started and kind of who the catalysts were in the movement.
RFR started in 2009, so it seems like there was this, and a lot of other foundations and even podcasts kind of started up at that time. So it seems like there was this big confluence of ideas, like, okay, we like the people identified, we need to do something, and they started stuff out. That's I had no idea that such luminaries really were involved at the very beginning. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's the more and more people that crossed Dan's path or reached out to Richard Dawkins or Daniel Dennett or Linda LaScola, you know, they just said, hey, this is more than just a few people. This is kind of almost an epidemic that's going on, and it's still going on today. I mean, we see, fast forward, I'll give you some stats. I mean, currently we have right around 1,150 people in the Clergy Project. And I see a couple of them here. I'm not going to scroll through. It's so good to see some of you here. I see Maureen Hart. She is our screener. If Maureen's waving there. If it wasn't for Maureen, I don't know if the thing would still be running. She really takes care of so many things for us. So she's awesome to have. But there's
so you have 1,100 members currently. Is this just like at the moment, or is this over the whole existence of Clergy Project?
No, this is over the entire existence, around 1,150.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, when you really stop and think about it, when I applied for the Clergy Project, you did not apply online. You kind of typed out your thing and sent it in, and it took me over a year. I mean, I was terrified.
Yeah,
I was terrified. We'll get into more of that, but it took me a year to sign up and get the courage to send that in. I was just scared.
And when about was that?
For me, I joined in 20. It was either 13 or 14. I'm a horrible historian. That's why I wrote all that other stuff down. That's why I was a believer. I'm a horrible historian, okay?
So what are some of the unique challenges that the clergy face when they, like, why is this so important, the work that the Clergy Project does?
Yeah, I tell you, and I'm always cautious to say this, because there is a lot of pain involved. I mean, I think 30 some percent of you said, you know, that there's some anger there from people just like me. I mean, I was the one standing up on the stage every week, pumping this stuff out. So I don't want to think more highly of ourselves than we should. But there is a unique challenge, because for many of us, or most of us, I mean, especially, you know, I don't want to be sexist or throw this out, but a lot of men, right, find their identity in their work. They find their passion in their work. You know, when you meet somebody, you say, hey, I'm Charles. Hey, I'm Tim. Oh, hey, what do you do? So not only is it an identity, but it goes beyond that, because it's a supernatural thing, right? I mean, it's your whole life. And if your family's entrenched in it, and it's been a part of who you are. It's your complete identity. You feel like you are some sort of superhero for God, right? It's our job to rescue people from going to burn in an eternity in hell forever. And you dedicate your life to that. You know you're not going to get paid maybe the most, and you're willing to give that up. You know that it's going to be a challenge. You know you're going to work long hours. But you're willing to do it because you really feel like it's such a higher calling. So a lot of people, I don't know what they think of that at first. Obviously, career transition is a huge thing. I mean, when you deconvert from the faith and you deconstruct, obviously, for many of these pastors, like I have a master's of theology, that doesn't translate too well into the corporate world or something else. So a lot of these pastors, they don't know what to do to get a different job. They're not sure where they're qualified. They're not sure how to explain it. Because for those of us that haven't figured it out yet, to be an atheist in America is somewhere below. I think last time I honestly looked at the Pew Religious Forum, we were like two notches below like Islamic terrorists. Can anybody confirm that? I mean, that's literally where it was. So.
Yeah.
You know, it's how do you build a resume? How do you do that? So loss of income.
So one of the big issues that they face is that they're just not trained for anything but standing behind the pulpit. Where else can you earn money putting together a sermon every day or every week or it sounds like communication is something that they learn, but so they struggle with real world job skills.
Yep. So the transition out into the career is a big one. The other big one is, I mean, it's not easy to, and many of you know this story. I mean, it's not easy to go to your spouse and say, I no longer believe. I mean, especially if it's a pastor's wife or a pastor's husband. We do have 157 females that are in the Clergy Project. So we're really seeing an uptick in female people that are joining the Clergy Project. Maureen is one of those. It's just not easy to go to your spouse and to say, I no longer believe, because for many of us, it might even be something that you hadn't talked about with your spouse, because that's a secret that if it gets out, it can wreck the church. It can ruin the church. It can ruin your livelihood. And maybe it's your spouse that's having questions. They don't want to talk about it either. So when you do talk about it, unfortunately, we see a lot of our people that when they deconstruct, they end up with a really rocky road to marriage. So a lot of our people are divorced. Then it gets into what do you do with the kids? And I know this is a common theme amongst many of probably the viewers tonight, because it is an RRFR group, you know. That one person stays in the faith, one person doesn't. And how do you raise the kids? You know, they do one thing over here and one thing over there. So loss of just their immediate family and their house is tough. And then you get into the extended family. And I think for a pastor, it's a little bit even bigger than that, because we share so many moments with people when they're dying. We give them hope when they're dying. We counsel them when they're dying. We know some of their deepest, darkest secrets. And they really, you know, your extended family and friends and community feel a profound loss and almost a slap in the face when you, the person that they looked up to receive this guidance from, turns their back on it. So that's a big challenge. So from there, it rolls down into mental health issues. So you're setting up the perfect storm for just, you know, you've lost your career, you've lost your income, you're not sure what to do. Maybe you've lost your spouse, maybe you've lost your kids, you've lost your community, you've lost your faith. And so there's a lot of profound mental health issues that go on as well.
Your identity, it sounds like too, being wrapped up on it. Wow. What, you know, this might be a off the topic question, but what does a pastor normally make a professional clergy member normally make?
Oh, you mean financially?
Yeah. Like what are they losing? Of course, everything, but.
Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of church you are. I mean, you know, you've got the Joel Steens of the world that probably make millions, and then I don't think
he's going to be showing up in the clergy project.
Honestly, it's all over the place. It's from people that volunteer and they hardly get paid anything. I would say the average, if I could throw an average out there, it would probably be maybe $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And that would be a decent, you know, medium-sized church, you know, maybe with benefits. I think once you get in a larger church, 70 maybe these days, 60 or 70, I'm talking a pretty large church.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like from what you've been describing that a lot of the issues that like the clergy that they face when they leave is can even be more complicated than like the parishioner that is deconverting, you know, because there's this, because for those of people that have deconverted, they might not lose their job. They might not lose the support system and stuff like that. So it seems like not only on top of the deconversion, they have to go through this complete lifestyle change and learning new skills and stuff. So that just adds more complications on top of already going on through the deconversion process in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a complete overhaul. If you see me looking a little nervous, I mean, I'm used to speaking in front of, I think probably the largest crowd was 15,000 people. I have no problem talking, but I'm having trouble getting words out because it's still a painful.
Yeah, I understand. It sounds like it would be really painful, you know, and it's gonna bring up those emotions and stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I definitely feel for you. I really do, because it sounds like it's very complicated and messy and not fun. And when you're going through that shift, it can be, you know, traumatizing. So, you know, my heart really goes out to that because it is really, really complicated. And I don't think people, you know, really understand, you know, that side of it, you know, what's on the other side of, you know, the altar that was what's going on.
Well, I think the toughest thing, you know, at least in my personal case, you know, I mean, you've got a mom and dad that are proud, you know, that, you know, their son's preaching 5 or 6 times a weekend in a large church.
Wow.
You know, they raised you in the faith, you know, and you always want your kids to be successful and healthy. And if I was raised in the evangelical church, that's my personal background. And so, you know, it's a big deal. The Bible is the literal, infallible word of God, and truly people go to an eternity in hell and burn forever if they don't know Christ. And so it's a higher calling, you know, and if you're a part of this world, it'll make sense to, you know, rescue people from that eternity of separation. And so, you know, my mom and dad were super proud. My family was proud. They gave money. They gave a lot of money. It was very, very difficult to, you know, tell. You tell your parents that they raised you wrong. And, you know, I mean, that's a tough, that's, and I know that this is a similar story to many people out there. You had to do the same thing. I think the small departure is when you start thinking about the fact that you are, you know, unfortunately looked up to as the person that has the advanced degree, the word from the Lord, and that you're making a difference in a community. I mean, we were in a small community, a tiny little town. And I think our last Easter there, we had like 2,300 people in a town of, I think it was 2,900 people. And so you really do see some good impact of the church, and that's up for debate. We have some really good talks in our RFR group about whether or not the church can bring some good. You know, certainly we saw people that, you know, left a lifestyle of drugs or other crazy things that were going on in their lives, but really we know that that higher power was themselves ready and willing to change. And so, yeah, it's a very tough transition. For us, it was something that we didn't expect. My wife and I never talked about any kind of doubts. We never wanted to, you know, form that doubt with each other. And certainly you wouldn't go talking to anybody else about it, because we know how word gets out.
Yeah. You and I have talked, you know, in the past before, and this for a lot of kind of about this, and for a lot of, I think pastors or ministers, this is generational. Their yep. fathers did it, their father's fathers did it, and their father's father. You know, I've talked to folks who can trace their pastoral roots way back to the 18th, 17th century, and. Right. But that wasn't necessarily the case for you. Where did you kind of start out, and how did you get into becoming a pastor in your small town?
Well, I'll try to keep it a little bit brief here. You know, I think we all have a really unique backstory, right? And when you start peeling back the layers, so, you know, there were some dysfunctional things that were going on in the home, some alcoholism and things like that. My father was a professional traveling businessman, though. So I saw some good leadership exemplified, but I saw a lot of dysfunction. Every Friday through Sunday was just a shit show at my house. And, you know, my mom found solace in the church. And we would be at the church twice on Sunday and every Wednesday. And the church was our life. And if you're used to this kind of background, from an early age, you know, I was a little hyper and I could talk and I could be animated like this, you know, and keep people's attention. And so it was always said to me that one day you're going to go on to do great things for the Lord. You're going to go on to, you know, truly win the nations, right? To use Christianese. And so from the time I was a smaller child, even, I remember people saying, you know, you have the gift from the Lord. So it was kind of almost, I felt like it was a little expected of me. I kind of went through a little bit of a rebellious phase, I guess you would say, in college, and kind of, again, forgive me for using all these Christian terms, but some of you will get it, was running from the Lord, right? Mm-hmm. I became a police officer first in Columbus, Ohio. So I served, and in the back of my mind, I always knew that one day I would, you know, kind of turn my life around a little bit. It wasn't anything crazy. I mean, you know, but I just, you know, wasn't as focused on the church and things like that as people would expect. But I was on the scene of a drive-by shooting. It was about my fourth year on, and there was a young man that had just been shot, and I was doing CPR on him, and his mom was sitting right beside him. I can still hear it, see it. I can see it all, even to this day, just holding his hand, saying, "Help him, Jesus, help him, Jesus, help him, Jesus, help him, Jesus, help him, Jesus." And I'm sitting there doing CPR on this young man. And as I drove away from there, I said, you know, it's time. It's time. It's time. The only thing that could have helped this young man is that maybe he find the Lord before a police officer like myself comes and has to do CPR. He ultimately passed away. So it was a little epiphany to me. So I went home. I told my wife, this is really bad practice. I said, honey, I think it's time. You know, I think it's time to answer that call that I know I've always had. We're going to go off to seminary. So I went off and got my master's degree at Ashland Theological Seminary, you know, did the whole thing, Hebrew, Greek, all of those things. And then we started a church. It's called Being a Church Planter. They wanted me to start a church kind of in the Columbus area, but I really felt, and I think this makes it a lot harder for me. I really felt like I should start a church in this small kind of economically dying area of Northeast Ohio. And so that's what we did. And I don't know if you want me to continue on. I mean, but that's how I got into it. And so I was a pastor and we started churches and we had campuses. I had a driver that would take me to other churches to speak. And if I wasn't live in the church, they would play a video. We had a campus in China where we would send our videos over and they would watch them in a house church. I mean, it was the whole nine yards.
Charles, I know you're not following in on the chat, but you're getting a lot of support from the folks who are here. Your story is touching them and they're really reaching out. And if this was a live in-person thing, I think you would be inundated with hugs. Yeah. So were all in, you and your wife were all in on this being a pastor and saving lives and saving people from hell and damnation. And it sounds like you were in front of a lot of people over the years as you were pastor. How long were you a pastor? I know you're not a great historian, but just
well, I left the police department in 2000 and I deconstructed in late 2012, 2013.
Yeah. What was kind of the trigger for you to start this deconstruction process?
I used to sit in, I can still see it today, seventh grade. And again, I don't have time and I don't want to get into my full story. It would make a lot more sense. Like I actually kind of grew up in a Bob Jones church. Extreme fundamentalism. Now the troubling part, I've got a lot of troubling part. My therapist makes a lot of money. So off of me. There's a lot of layers to peel back because, you know, I've got, you know, I had a dad that was, and my dad's an amazing man, quit drinking and doing all of those things. But, you know, he was a little absent in those years. So a youth pastor at the church took me under his wing. He was like a father to me. And so he's telling me one thing, you know, I mean, this was the kind of church where women could not wear pants, like even inside the home. Wow. Okay. It's the kind of church where, you know, the only kind of music you could listen to would be symphony music. But at the time, my mom was making a journey to and a shift of faith. Now, she's still in the faith, but she went from really conservative and now she would be like Pentecostal, maybe mildly Pentecostal. And so as she's shifting, she's telling me at home it's okay to listen to, and this will sound crazy to some of you guys, to listen to worship music. And then I'm going to church and being told how wrong that was.
Even listening to worship music was not okay by Bob Jones's standard.
No, wow. Not at all. So it was a pretty conservative, separatist kind of church. You know, the crazy thing is I remember being loved at that church though, because as a young man, you hear the preaching and you're like, really, do I really have to do that? So, and can I just be honest? It really fucks you up. It really does. My entire view. I just asked my therapist the other day. I said, I don't know what normal looks like. She was asking about my family, like my kids. And I said, can you just tell me what a normal dad is supposed to do? I mean, it's not like I didn't have a dad to show me, right? But I don't know, because you're taught such black and white thinking. You're taught that there is the exact certain way to live. Now, the church that we eventually started was nothing like what I grew up in. It was the kind of church where we had drums, we had band, we had jeans, you know, one of these cool hip churches, whatever. I didn't even know what, I don't know what normal looks like. And you know where I finally discerned that was at an RFR meeting. It was here at my house, and we had a Jehovah's Witness couple come in. And I was blown away because they were scared to death, said it took them like a year to finally work up the courage to come to our group. And she said the same thing. She said, I don't know what normal is. I don't, our kids don't know how to socialize with other kids. Mm. We don't know what a birthday party is. We don't know what a holiday is. We don't know what normal is. And it hit me hard that night. I don't either. Now, maybe not at that extreme, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm doing these things right. So I didn't expect to get so emotional tonight. So my apologies. Oh, but
It's perfectly okay. And we appreciate your vulnerability. Yep. You know, I mean, I would be surprised if it didn't affect you. So, you know, don't apologize for showing emotions. Feeling's going to feel. Yep. So it's perfectly all right.
So yeah, I mean, this is what we would deal with and with many of the people in the clergy project. Now, there are many people that join that have been out for 20 years and they figured it out. They might have gone through all of the shit. They might have already gone through the family loss, the family rejection, the loss of career, the loss of this, and they find us. But we deal with a lot of people. I was just talking with Lon, who's our president, Lon Ostrander, right before the call. That's why I was a couple minutes late. I said, do you have any idea why? And Maureen is our main screener that kind of vets and then pushes people off. But we've had this year 17 active and 17 former. We've never had that before. So we have a lot of people right now that are actively still in the ministry and trying to get out. And these are the people that we really, at least when I was screening them, I was following up regularly with them because I also didn't understand mental health. I mean, of course, we're taught counseling in seminary and you think mm-hmm. you can make it through. I never used to understand when people would sit in my office and say, I have suicidal thoughts. And I'd be like thinking to myself, I didn't say it, I wasn't this much of an asshole, but I didn't say the joy of the Lord is your strength, but I thought it. I thought, what aren't these people getting? You know, but I had a great job. I was looked up to. I was respected. Everybody knew me. My life was great. You know, I knew where I was going when I died. Yeah. And these people are hurting. And, you know, even in the evangelical world, I mean, it's more accepted today than it was even in 2012, 2010. But medication for depression or anything like that, you just weren't giving your entire life over to God, right? So I didn't understand that. And so when I found myself, you know, just the first year out, because it's not what I wanted to do. I would have bet $1 million in my bank account if you would have asked me in 2011 if I would be doing this talk tonight. Not a gambling man, but I would have bet it and I'd have lost. And when my life deconstructed because I could no longer believe in a God that would send somebody to an eternity in hell, and there were more reasons than that. I mean, there's plenty of reasons, but the more I traveled around the world and got out of my bubble and I met more people, and I traveled to speak in other countries, I started doing the math, I started thinking about it, and all of those things that I had pushed off into the back closet. Because what we tend to do is we tend to, when you confront a theological problem or a scientific problem, many people take that and they put it in this back closet and they shut the door. Well, I'm sorry, they go find an answer. Okay, you go find a reasonable answer, whether it be Ken Ham, as if that's reasonable, or apologetics, you know, the study of the defense of the faith. You go and you find this answer, it pacifies you, even as a theological person. Of course you don't preach about that. I never once preached a sermon on the 4,192 contradictions of scripture. You don't do that. You just don't do that. So you take those things, you tuck them away in the back of your mind, and you know, all of a sudden one day all of those things come out. I began with telling you the story and I got sidetracked in seventh grade. I used to sit, there was up on the science room, there was the 9-month development of an embryo, a fetus, right? And I'm sitting there in my head, the ADD kid that I was, thinking about science that I was being taught about evolution versus what I was being taught in the church. And it really didn't make sense to me, because what science was teaching was, I would sit there and say, that looks like a tadpole. That looks like a, you know, I would sit and look at the continents on the globe, and I'd be like, I remember going and asking my pastor, I'm like, bro, like, the continents look like they fit together as a puzzle. Oh no, that can't, you know, that's just what scientists wants to tell you. And that's what Satan puts in your head to lead you astray. So one day when that door is kicked open, the more I loved God, the more I loved people, and that sounds arrogant, but the more I loved God and the more I loved people, I thought this, and I'll land the plane with this, Eric, but I thought, if the God of the Bible is the God that I have to serve for the rest of eternity, then I must be a more moral being than him. Because if I go to heaven and he puts these crowns on my head and I have this golden mansion and I walk the streets of gold, the first thing I'm going to do is walk up and throw my crowns down at his feet, like the Bible says, and then say, could you please send me to hell, you know, rotten bastard, because I'd rather burn in hell for eternity than to sit in heaven and party and get fat and sing songs to you for the rest of my life while I'm thinking about people literally burning and screaming in hell.
Wow. That's pretty powerful. And it sounded like it was an accumulation of stuff over time, but then there was just one time or one thing that busted open this closet. You were keeping all these doubts and cognitive dissonance in your, wow, Charles, what a story. Yep. And so then you were kind of stuck in this professional role as a spiritual leader. You were going through this. And what happened after that? How did you either find the Clergy Project, or how did you kind of continue to preach from the pulpit with these thoughts and going on in the front of your head?
So again, I my story could take several of these sessions. So let me just tell this quickly. I was in between church plants. And the one thing that you don't want to give to somebody that stays busy is a little more time on my hands. And I really sought out for a year. They gave me a year kind of, they call it a sabbatical. We were going to start a church in Columbus. That was our next church plant. And I had time to really figure out. I was trying to figure out, was I in the right denomination? Were the gifts of the Spirit, you know, like shit that you read in the Bible, like it stuff wasn't stacking up, right? And so it wasn't a doubt for me, but it was like trying to really find the best, because there's so many different thoughts and denominations and ways to interpret the Bible. So I really sought it out. YouTube was big at the time. It was kind of just, I don't know when it kicked off, but this would have been 2012, 2013. I sought out spirits. I sought out demons. I sought out true miracles, because they always seem to happen on the other side of the world. And the miracles that happened in my church were the guy that went and was healed of cancer, but really it was a surgeon that took out his cancer out of his body in the chemotherapy. So I really sought that out. And my wife and I never talked about any kind of doubts. I will say that maybe a year or two before that, Rob Bell's book came out called Love Wins, which is about the problem of hell. And I didn't want to read it. But his little promo video, if you haven't read it, or if you haven't watched his promo video, it's actually kind of powerful, because it left an impression on me that kind of wound down my faith journey. But as I was seeking out to see what denomination, I mean, I went to the Vineyard Church and took classes on how to speak in tongues. And being the kind of person that really wanted to vet truth, because it might not seem like truth might be all that important with all the cognitive dissonance that went on with me, it's very important. And so that's why I was just trying to discern what the truth was. What is the truth? And my son is, he's just all of my kids are brilliant. They're just wonderful kids. He's pretty brilliant. I'll brag on him. Summa cum laude, graduated with yesterday, 4.0 Ohio State. He's an intern at the U.S. House of Representatives right now. Just a smart kid. Was reading the stream.
Awesome sauce.
Huh?
Awesome sauce.
he brought a book home on the string theory in like sixth grade. And I'm like, man, I got to catch up with this kid. So long story short, as I was seeking all of these things out, trying out these different churches, trying to figure out where you're going to land, my son came up to me, and there's several other stories in here, but this would be the final one. And he came up to me. We were on the back deck of our house, and he said, Dad, I've been reading the book of Revelation today, which every kid does, right? He was in seventh grade. So I was reading the book of Revelation. He said, why does God have to be so mean? I said, well, what do you mean, son? He said, why does God have to be so mean? You know, plagues, boils, blood up to the horse's bridle. Why can't he just snap his fingers and everybody just like silently go to sleep? Why does he have to be so mean? And again, there's a few other stories in there that connect this, but at that very moment, I struggled a little bit because at that moment I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, you're right, kid. And I gave him the Bible answer. You know, God is just, he's all powerful. His ways are higher than our ways. You know, who are we to question God? You know, these are sinful, unrighteous people. They're getting their due justice. Doesn't this sound horrible? But that's what I said. But here's the thing. Truth is really important to me. It really is. And in that moment, when my son, he looked at me, he goes, oh, okay, okay. He walked away. But in that moment, I knew that I had lied to my son. And we had never... I'd never talked to my wife about any of this stuff, and I was terrified. I knew I had lied to my son. I said, oh my gosh, I don't believe this. I had never read Dawkins. I had never read Hitchens. I had never read any of this stuff. I knew who they were. We were told not to read them because it would infect your mind, right? And I did what you should always do, the wisest thing you could ever do. I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to march right in and tell my wife. And we are a very unique story for the Clergy Project. There are a few people that might have had this experience, but I walked in. I said, honey, I've got to talk to you about something important. And she looked terrified and said, what? I said, I don't believe this anymore. Mm. She said, what don't you believe? I said, I don't believe anymore. What don't you believe? In hell or God? Or I said, in God. And the craziest thing, my wife looked at me and said, oh, good, because I haven't believed for 6 months. And so I really expected her to like walk out that day. I thought between the deck and my living room, I thought, here comes my divorce. Mm. And wow. So I think we were a little bit unique in that. But a lot of these people that come to the Clergy Project, they don't have, you know, that same story. I mean, my wife and I never talked about doubts. It is a little weird. And I did have time off, like I said, to think about it. And I think the biggest thing, because some of you are wondering, like, well, is this going to stick? I mean, it was 2012. And one of the things, if you want to defend the faith well, you do have to know the other side. Now, I'd never read a ton about atheism, but I could defend the faith. I mean, I could defend the faith. And all of those cards came crashing down. Because unbeknownst to me, I was so cognitively dissonant. I was so lying to myself that when I knew I lied to my son, I knew the charade was up. I was just way too scared to ever be alone with my thoughts and think through that on my own.
What a powerful story, Charles. Yeah, thank you powerful. So much for sharing that. I'm looking at the video feeds and there's hardly any dry eyes from what you've shared. It's touched a lot of people. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And so how did you find the Clergy Project? What was the impetus to seek out maybe the other folks kind of went through something or similar?
Well, you know, being a guy that built up this ministry and traveling around the country, I mean, I have entrepreneurial skills. I had counseling. But I found myself in a place where, circling back to the story of, I mean, I'm not afraid to admit it. I had uncontrollable, like, thoughts of just dying. And, you know, because I was terrified, I couldn't tell my parents, my family, the town. I mean, I grew up with these people. I love those people. Still to this day, I love these people, right? Yeah. I mean, they're family, they're friends. It's hard. It's still hard to this day. That's why I still have a therapist. And I'm so thankful for RFR and TCP and the Secular Therapy Project, because I've told you guys before, I mean, I think it's saved, very well could have saved our lives. So I just started seeking things out. And, you know, thankfully we had the internet, and I found this, I found the Clergy Project. And I, again, I wadded up three applications to them because I was sure that somebody was going to find me out. And, you know, I finally applied, and, you know, wonderful people like Maureen and Lawn, and I don't know who all's on here because I can barely look at the screen tonight, guys, but, you know, they just welcomed me with open arms, and they said, it's okay, you're not alone. And I couldn't believe it, that there was that many people that shared my same story. I was not alone. And, you know, you build up little networks, and there's a search tool. So I found people in the area. That's actually how I found RFR. One of the guys that was in the Clergy Project was leading a really small group for RFR here in Columbus. And that's, you know, when you start meeting other people and talking to them, you realize you're not alone. You're not crazy. And from there, I found the Secular Therapy Project after I went through two therapists, because I didn't know about the Secular Therapy Project. And I had two therapists that made it worse for me because they didn't understand my story. They didn't understand the exodus out of religion. They said, why don't you just go tell your parents? I think you would feel better. I'm like, can you give me some pointers? So, you know, I eventually found the tool on you all's website and was connected with the therapist who said, yeah, let's not do that yet.
Understanding it from the clergy's position or experience in the Clergy Project, you filled out an application and you were then vetted. You have an interview, and once you were interviewed, they said, hey, yeah, you're a great candidate. Did they let you into a private chat room and you got to meet people through there?
Okay. So yeah, let's shift that and away from just my personal story. But to be honest with you, my story is very much like so many people in the Clergy Project. So that's why I wanted to share that. But,
I can totally see that. And I'm really glad, because I can, from hearing your story, I can see how different it is from mine in some sense, but similar. But the struggles that you were facing were almost multiplied in some sense as a religious leader.
Yeah. And it's great to have a community like that, because when you have an identity that's wrapped up in saving the world, what do you want to do when you finally find your new truth, right? So the best thing was running into other people, you know, that said, yeah, don't go do that right now. Why don't you just figure out who you are? I was a hot mess already, trying to figure out how to get a new career and keep my family and, you know, deal with all the nonsense that was going on. So the Clergy Project has the main, we have three main points that we, or three main foundations. The first is a super secret backdoor community online forum. We've got, you know, all kinds of forums that you can get into: coming out issues, couples issues, children and family issues, emotional and psychological issues, medical and health issues. humanism, science, philosophy, religion, social media, just all kinds of things that whatever issue you're facing at that time. So if it's, how do I talk to, I just went on there today and looked, and there's several new people that have posted about relationship issues. How do I tell my wife? You know, how do I tell my family? So the online forum was what the original launch point was in 2011 for the Clergy Project. And you can go on there and you can post, and people will follow up and they will give advice. I'm so busy that I tend to not write novels to people. I'll just send them my phone number, say, I think I can maybe share my story. Because we do a lot of that, just like we do at RFR. We don't want to give advice because everybody's situation might be unique, but our story is powerful. And sharing our story is comforting, and it's educational, and it's sometimes the best therapy you can have. The second thing that we do is through a generous grant from the Stiefel Foundation, they gave $100,000 for what's called our TAG grant, which is Transitional Assistance Grant, which is to help with career changes. How do you write your resume to fit into what you're trying to get into? We just had two people graduate from the revamped program. A great guy who's been on some of these calls too, Joe Pittenger, runs that now for us. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's 20 some sessions on how to revamp, how to interview. I mean, I was a horrible interviewer. I was a great talker, but I had no idea how to interview in the corporate world. They thought I was crazy. I mean, I thought I hired all these people. I'd certainly know how to interview. I was horrible. I had no idea. So we provide career, you know, guidance and transition, suggestions for what people can do for other potential careers. And the third thing is, and it's in conjunction with you all. And that's why RFR TCP is really a blur in my mind, except for the fact that at this far end is TCP, where you have to be clergy. And that's the Secular Therapy Project, because you can just tell a lot of these people, and Maureen can probably, you know, speak to this as well, that when you talk to them, you can just feel and hear, and we're not trying to diagnose this, but you can see the mental, the mental trauma that they're going through. And so we connect them up with, you know, a secular therapist, hopefully in their area, that can help walk them through that. And believe it or not, many of them are resistant to it right off the bat. You know, it's tough. It's tough stuff to unpack, but then there's other people that want to go and get the help that they need. So those are the three facets that we provide.
That's beautiful. It sounds like it kind of supports the folks coming out of the Clergy Project exactly how they need it to be. Do you feel that there's an additional program or additional something that these clergy members need that the Clergy Project isn't able to address right now?
The wonderful thing about our community is that if you want the help, you can get it. If you want to network with people, that's cool. You can figure that out. If you, we're all volunteers. I mean, thank goodness for some of these people that give just a ton of time to the organization, as I do, because if it weren't for the volunteers that are also working full-time jobs, and by the way, we're still struggling, you know, that's why, how long did it take me to get you this outline? You know, because I'm working a couple jobs and I'm doing RFR, I'm doing TCP. It's tough, but if you really want to connect and figure it out, it's there. It's there. So, I mean, the biggest thing that's probably missing, and this is going to sound like a really bad pastoral thing, is, I mean, I think we receive about $900 a month. So obviously, okay, if people feel the you know, feel like this is something that they would want to donate to, you know, certainly that's probably our biggest piece. And I'm kind of in charge of that in the next year, of trying to, you know, raise up, you know, a little bit stronger funding so that we can help. One of the things that we'd like to help with now that comes to mind, and it really is because of a lack of funds, is some of these pastors would get out kind of, I really believe that they would get out right away if we could provide them just a few months of rent and things like that. I mean, you know, think about it. It's,
yeah.
So
I think that you make a really excellent point that how valuable community is to folks, because it's not just about like chatting on Facebook or in a ICQ chat like way back in the day, or AOL or something. It's not about that at all. You nailed it when you said, like, this is about networking. This is about how do I do even some of the very basic stuff that folks aren't used to. And if the community is open to it and open to really being empathetic towards these folks and understand where they're coming from, that is incredibly valuable. And it shouldn't be understated how important the community is.
Yeah, I mean... Go ahead.
I was going to ask you on top of that, like I was going to piggyback off Eric. So what kind of skill sets are you looking, like if people want to volunteer to help like train clergy members to transition into like the working world, what kind of skills are you looking for that people would be able to volunteer to do to help train?
Well, and that's a tricky one. And that's one thing that I wrote down tonight, because of the super confidentiality part, I'm not sure, because I really appreciated that question that was on the list of, you know, how could our people help? So I guess the person would have to say, yes, I'm okay being out, because most people, when they join, they have a pseudonym. I mean, we're scared to death. We don't trust anybody.
Right. I understand that.
So, you know, It was very difficult. I mean, I couldn't go back to being a police officer. I actually got injured at the police department, so it just wasn't going to work out for me. That's the only thing I could think of doing. I mean, I knew that I had other skills, but what in the hell are those? I mean, I wouldn't know. I mean, literally the rug was pulled out from underneath me. And that's the same for a lot of them. Now, some people, if they had transitioned, maybe they were selling insurance or they were doing this, or they were a part-time, what's called bivocational pastor, they can slide back into that part easier. So not everybody has the trifecta of broken marriage, mental health, career. I mean, and some people do. Some people might have one of the three. But as far as jobs, I mean, you know, we see a lot of our people. I was super proud of this one gentleman that called me not long ago, that he's gone back and he just completed his degree to become a licensed therapist, like did the whole nine yards. And he really has a focus around religious trauma because he understands that. And he started a therapy practice. So a lot of people do look toward counseling. They look toward, some people have gone back and got teaching degrees, but these are pretty daunting things, right? I mean, I don't know. I'd recommend a lot of people go apply at Target right now. I saw they're giving out, they're going to pay your college now. So,
right.
I mean, but think about it. Just all of a sudden you have to completely change your job, and you know, you can't lie on a resume. I mean, how do you spin your career as a pastor and a master of theology? I mean, what in the hell is that?
Okay. So we talked about some of the projects that, or some of the foundational parts of the clergy project. Are there any project that you guys are currently working on that might be, we can expect to see or soon enough that would be helpful for folks?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to like what I do as the communications director, and unfortunately it's the tyranny of the urgent. I mean, we've got a backorder issue at work, and I've got surgeons calling me saying, I've got patients bleeding out on the table, get me a damn device. And so like many of you at your jobs, you might be expecting you might be experiencing labor shortages, you might be experiencing backorders like me. It's just crazy. And so a lot of these things, as a volunteer, if you want to do it right, it just takes some time. So we've been talking about this for a long time, but we're actually So we are going to, you know, amongst our members, do some polling of our members, really reach out, start to get a little bit more data over these last 10 years. That's something that we haven't followed up with a ton of people. And so we'd love to hear that. We'd like to raise some funds. And then one of the things that we're going to do is share stories from the Clergy Project, because one of the things that I've noticed, you can go to YouTube and a pastor can be sitting in the middle of the woods and filming his deconversion story on a dark camera, and it barely makes any sense, and it'll have like a million views. Now, don't ask me why. The same people that lead people astray, like myself, are the ones that people can't wait to hear their deconversion story from. I know it's a little counterintuitive, but that's just how it works many of the times. And so we're just going to share our stories. So we're going to do a podcast, but we need another podcast. Like, we need a, you know, kind of a hole in the head. It's not going to be a topical. There's people that do that way better, and that we're just going to share our stories. So like, you know, kind of like what I did tonight, except maybe a little bit longer form, where we get into our story for 30 or 45 minutes. And we're going to categorize them, because Maureen's story, I know that Maureen, we talk about this often. She was a nun and in the Catholic Church, and her experience of recovering from religion is very different than us crazy evangelicals, she would say.
Maureen is here and unmuted.
Yeah.
Maureen, do you want to say something?
Well, in asking what else the Clergy Project needs, I think we need more visibility, which is what Charles is addressing through podcasts or whatever. But if we're over 1,000 now, there are many times more than that people who probably are in the same boat that Charles was in and I was in that don't know that there's a place for them. Mm-hmm. And we don't advertise. So how do you get the visibility? That's one thing that, and Charles is working on that, along with fundraising to help people who need some, you know, have fallen through the cracks and between jobs. And then my personal experience is that we have participants who are in the Secular Therapy Project through recovery, but the therapist has to be in the state that the participant is in. They have to be licensed there. And that's, I don't know how many therapists you have and how many states are actually covered. And then we tell them that if one therapist doesn't work out, they can try somebody else, as you would in any other situation. So I don't know what the variety of people, but now I'm in Maine, and I know there's somebody who very badly needed a therapist, a secular therapist. And there was no one in Maine for that person. I think they applied, there wasn't. So I would say the therapy list is wanting.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Along with the fundraising and becoming more visible to people who they don't know they need us, but they do.
Yeah. So it sounds like the main way people can find you is through the internet, just an internet search at the moment. You guys don't do any advertising, but it sounds like you're starting to make some of the podcast rounds to kind of get the word out a little bit more.
There's printed material. There are magazine articles about us. There are books that talk about the Clergy Project. The internet's a big thing.
Brochures that you leave in churches and things like that.
Say that again.
You have brochures that you leave in churches. And
I had that idea years ago. Why don't we just send a letter to all the pastors in America and say, just letting you know we're here. That didn't go over too well. So
Maureen would do it too. Don't mess with Maureen.
And, well, I thought something in old-fashioned mail would be more effective than sending, you know, the thousands of emails that people get. I thought a nice, very simple letter. We're here. You need us.
Yes.
It sounds like this is a tricky problem to get in front of the people who need it, because they may most likely aren't going to be in the same circles that most of us are in. They're not listening to maybe atheist podcasts or stories or ex-religion podcasts or stories. And they're still heavily inside of that community that they don't want to leave. So it sounds really kind of tricky to get to these, the folks who need them.
Yeah, I mean, I received a couple stories to share tonight, people from other countries even, that, I mean, we think we have it bad here. You know, they're under the threat of death. I mean, so if we think it's bad to lose a job, they're under the threat of losing their life. I mean, it's a real challenge for many of these people around the world. We do hope to make a pretty big splash when we, you know, share our stories. And that's all it's going to be. We're going to share our stories through podcast, and people that are Baptist or Buddhist or Presbyterian or whatever can really relate to, you know, what you're saying, just like finding, you know, a therapist that can relate with you. You know, and so we hope to kind of roll it all out at the same time and make a little bit of a splash. The Clergy Project made quite a splash in 2011, 2012, 13. You know, it was kind of a new thing and people were very interested. It's kind of time that we do that again. And it's also in conjunction with you guys, Eric, because guess what? 99.5% in America don't qualify for our little exclusive group. So really, we hope that we wanted to bring awareness to the Clergy Project because people don't know about us. Not, I could tell you a million stories, guys, but I just talked to somebody the other day. I preached at this church down in Florida. It was thousands of people. I mean, thousands, over 10,000 people. This guy found me on Facebook. I didn't want to tell him that I was deconverted. This is the first big public thing I've ever done. That's why I was pretty nervous there, guys. You know, I'm sure I could not believe the retweets of this. And I went, oh, shit, you know, because you got to deal with it. But, you know, I'm in the space where we can do that. But I talked to this guy and he kept hammering me. Why aren't you a pastor anymore? I said, you don't want to know the answer. I don't really want to talk about it. He kept hammering me. Well, come to find out, finally, I said, listen, you know, and he's in Florida and I'm up here. And I said, I'm deconverted. I no longer believe. And he goes, I'm so glad you said that. And come to find out, so he's been to a couple of our online meetings now, but he said, you're the first person. He was a children's pastor at this church. And that's why I didn't want to share with him and then have everybody in the world call me like, oh my God. But he said in 7 years, he hasn't been to church in 7 years, come to find out. He said, you're the first person I've talked to about this. My wife doesn't know. 7 years. I mean, I waited 7 seconds to tell my wife. And he's actually come to, like I said, a couple of our support group meetings online. So it's people like that that haven't heard about it, that didn't know there was anything out there like us that we want to be able to do. And then the other 99.5% of people that might hear one of our stories or something, they're going to get turned your way because, you know, they qualify for you guys, but might not qualify for us.
Well, let's kind of, this has been just a fantastic conversation. Let's kind of wrap up with two things. And Maureen, you're welcome to jump in as well. What do you feel like is this a great success story that the Clergy Project can share? Not necessarily about a person, but what is something that you're really proud of that came about because of the Clergy Project?
You've been around longer than me, Maureen. I'll pass that down to you. What are you most proud of?
I think that they really are personal stories. They're people that have been in really dire straits, just twisting themselves in knots over what they were doing, how they were, the hypocrisy of their lives, and have found the support. They're not alone. They're not the only one that this happened to. And you know, when we don't like to say you lost your faith, most of us have ditched it. It isn't some precious thing that we, you know, that fell by the wayside. We thought it through one way or another, through the Bible or whatever circumstance. And they've come through that, and the support is there for them, and they have found more mental peace and joy in the world and joy in their own natural lives. And they have found that they are good without God, and that this is their one and only life. They're not living for the next one. In the best of situations, maybe the family has come along with them and they haven't lost too many friends, but that's not too common. That's usually been, at least some people have had to even leave town if they've been in a big church in town, and wherever they go, people recognize them, and it's the, you know, they've got the big A on their forehead. That's not an easy way to live, uncomfortable standing in line at the supermarket. So people have had to move in that, but I think the success stories are personal. People living miserable lives, begging God, first of all, to please give me my faith back. What have I done wrong? I'm trying so hard to save souls. And have found their way through that and found that life is worth living without God.
Can't think of a better success story than that, because I experienced a similar thing. And Helen, you might be able to say something like that too, but as a support group leader, seeing people walk in to the meetings broken and at the end of the rope, and then walk out of the meeting with hope and an experience of courage and bravery is seeing the light at the end of the tunnel is so fulfilling so we'll kind of wrap up this discussion with kind of one final question before we go to the Q&A session. What do you see as the future for the Clergy Project?
You know, I think the future of the Clergy Project is just continuing to do what we do. I mean, this was a big step for me. I came out in 2012. For years on my RFR, for my RFR group, my support group on Meetup, that's not easy to find. I didn't even put my name. I don't know if you guys were around then. I wouldn't put my name on there. You know, it was a big step for me to put my name. And this is a big step tonight, because this is a pretty big public thing, you know, that got tweeted out, and I'm sure I'll get emails and hate mail and things like that, because there have been a few people that have found some things out. But, you know, I'm ready for that now, and I'm okay with that. You're still worried about it because Columbus, Ohio is still, unless you're downtown, as soon as you step out of downtown, it's kind of the semi-Bible Belt, right? The heartland of America. Right. We had a psychology professor from Ohio. Oh, shit. That might be too confidential. We had, anyway, this person was going for their tenure. And this person explained in our group that they were scared to death to share that they, and this is psychology at Ohio State, that they were no longer a believer. And so many people still fear for their jobs, because especially with the rise, it's not like politics and religion and mixing the two or anything new, but it really has hit a heightened point. And so again, when you say I deconverted, they immediately put you in a camp, and that can cause you a lot of problems. So we're seeing a lot of exodus from the church, right? And these people, just like the original vision that Dan Barker and Dan Dennett and Richard Dawkins and, you know, just all of the people, there are so many people too that were instrumental early on in the Clergy Project, envisioned a halfway house for people coming out, because I think it's going to just continually, exponentially grow the amount of people that are coming into the Clergy Project. Yeah. And I know you guys have seen tremendous growth. I mean, we've had over 1,000 people in our support group in Columbus, Ohio, and I have not advertised one time. We just put something on Meetup. I mean, over 1,000 people. So there's such a need, and I think that's just going to continue to grow exponentially.
Charles Maureen, thank you so much for sharing your story and kind of talking about the Clergy Project. This has been just fantastic. There's been a lot of love and empathy in the chat as I've been watching it. And we also have got quite a few questions that have been asked too. And Maureen, if you want to stick around and help with some of the questions, it'd be great. But Helen, you want to start off with asking the first question?
Absolutely, I can do that. Let me scroll up here. Okay. So the first question that came up is, this is kind of towards the beginning of your talk of free of supernatural belief is very broad. So someone believes in an afterlife. So even in that paradigm, without a God, is this excluded? Examples out of body experiences, dream messages, near-death experiences, etc. So do you get some of that, you know, when you're dealing with people that are diverging, that are from in the Clergy Project?
Maureen's a good one to answer that because you are the screener. And
we say, I mean, this is a big gray area, more gray than black and white. Mm-hmm. You want to consider what's supernatural, what's spirituality, what is God, what are all the entities that, you know. So while the Clergy Project, where we don't want to encourage people to their doubts and to give up their faith, they come to the Clergy Project after they've come to that conclusion as best as they can, as best as we can know. And it is the belief that there is no supernatural force directing our lives, having created, there is no afterlife, there is no God, no heaven, no hell, no angels. Mm-hmm. And we kind of go with that. Atheist is without God and the forces that God would be. So we have, and it's a, I guess it's individual. We have some pagans, we have some Wicca, what else, Buddhist. And so those are kind of, like I say, the gray area is bigger than the, mm-hmm. than the black and white areas, that, you know, for every definition of spirituality is, but anyway, that's basically.
Yeah, and that's, some of those groups are newer and we're kind of trying to trudge through that, but you know, the majority of our people, so, and I think the main reason behind that is because we aren't a place like RFR could be a place for people that still have one foot in and one foot out. But the Clergy Project, you know, you're going through such difficult times. We don't need people on there that are actually putting doubt upon people's doubt.
Do you guys know what the denominational breakdown of your members? I would assume it's mostly Christian, but how many ex-rabbis or ex-priests or ex-imams are currently being served by the Clergy Project?
I think Charles has the stats in front of him.
Well, I do, but in order to count those up, I'd have to do an Excel thing, and that would take way too long. Let me just tell you this, because I did write this down as possibly something to say. So in 2021, so far we've had 3 Church of Christ, 6 Pentecostal, 1 Lutheran, 2 Methodist, 7 Baptist, 2 Presbyterian, 3 Evangelical Non-Denominational, 5 Anglican Episcopal, 1 Seventh-day Adventist, 2 Catholic, 1 Brethren, and 1 Buddhist.
And a partridge in a pear tree, I assume.
Yeah.
Damn.
Wow. So. Got it. And just kind of, do you have any idea the percentage of the clergy who currently are in front of the pulpit don't know about Clergy Project and are non-believers? Do you have any guesses or anything like that?
That don't know about the Clergy Project?
Well, like if you take all of the clergy as one and they are currently working, and how many do you think are suspect are not believing?
I suspect it's a very high number, a very high percentage. And especially now, there's just so much more information there, and people can feel that there are others with them and that their doubts are not you know, coming from an evil place, that they begin to have a wake up call. They're having an epiphany, and it's more comforting to stay where they are. It's more secure to stay where they are. But, so I think if they knew about the Clergy Project, they might make that step and explore and admit to themselves what's happening. I think just from the Catholic priest standpoint, I think there's probably one priest told me when he joined that by the time they were through seminary and ready for ordination, that he thought that the probably 80% of the seminarians did not believe in transubstantiation. This is before ordination. Now, this is a big deal. It's not to most of you, but in the Catholic Church, that is the basis of it's the Eucharist is the makes us different than the Protestants. And so to hear him say that, I was shocked. And I think
I thought you were done.
Go ahead.
It's really interesting. Maureen and I have good conversations because being an evangelical or a Baptist or a Pentecostal is very different on how people enter the Clergy Project. I see that with my RFR group. The folks that are Catholic, you know, after all of these years, it's they kind of fit into a pretty, you know, whoop. And then those people that were evangelical or more of the conservative faith, they tend to struggle a lot more. And they tend to struggle with their faith. Those people that are more right-leaning in their theology, they are the ones that very well, and Linda LaScola is somebody would be good to talk to because she did the in-depth research, her and Daniel Dennett, about some of these backdoor things that were confidential. But those people that are to the right of literalist in the Bible, so there's a line that you cross when you go from literalist interpretation to more of a liberal theology. And those people that are more liberal in theology, they tend to be the ones that are willing to stay and maybe even stay longer because they've already had several progressions of maybe little mini losses of faith and theological positions, unlike those of us over here that instead of having a loss, we create an excuse or a reason of cognitive dissonance to hide in that back closet and forget about. I don't know if that makes sense. So I would say, I wouldn't say in the evangelical church, it's super high because it could be 20%, 25%. I don't know how many struggling, but typically there's such passion involved and it's such a whole giving of like your entire heart and spirit and being and all of this stuff that I probably shouldn't even still be using these terms, that those are the people, and you can see in the numbers reflected, 7 Baptists, 6 Pentecostal. I mean, that's what we tend to see because those are the people that are like, I don't know if I can keep doing this anymore because I'm going to be found out.
Got it.
That was a long explanation. I'm sorry.
No, it's fantastic. It was just what was needed. Helen, what do we have next?
So this kind of ties into what we've been talking about. So have you found that former clergy, do they tend to like navigate with other beliefs during their deconstruction period, or the people that come to you are pretty much done with any sort of religious or spiritual belief?
Yeah, they have to be.
Okay.
They have to be. So there are some people, and Maureen can maybe answer it better, but I think the answer is if they're not quite there yet, they would be asked to reconcile that and potentially come back because of the confidentiality. We have had people, this question might already be posted, we have had people join the Clergy Project and reconvert. And that's, you know, I mean, it's not a super high percentage. I actually think we have a list of people that have identified as that, but it has happened. So we certainly don't want people coming in and being nosy or outing a bunch of people. So they need to be done. Yeah.
That kind of makes sense though, because the fact that you're deconstructing and two, you have to completely reconstruct your life. Sometimes, you know, you stay in hell because you know the streets. So you go back to it and fall back into it because that's what you know. And and the actual process of it, you know, from what you're describing, sounds like you're climbing up, you know, a hill with only a knife to pull you up, you know. So, you know, it seems very, you know, that it kind of makes sense that some of them would just fall back into a belief system and go back to where they were doing before.
I would say in 10 years and over 1,000 people, there may have been 10 people who wanted to be removed from the roster.
It probably, I know it happens a lot more maybe with lay people. Yeah. I know that. Yeah. I think because, listen, once you are a pastor and you have expressed your lack of faith and you start talking about it, it's kind of like you're going to have the plague for a long time. So it's going to be hard to circle back. And we really try to make sure that people are firm in not believing in the supernatural.
We've got time for two more questions. This has been a great conversation and it's gone long, but that's fine. One of the questions that we got is, if you have already left the ministry, does that kind of disqualify you to be a part of the Clergy Project or be brought into the Clergy Project?
No, we're for current and former ministers. That's quite clear. And most of our participants are former ministers. I think Charles, in the beginning, you said about 25% were still in pastoral roles.
Well, we had 839 former and 298 active, but I called Lon before this session and I said, have we figured out why in 2021 we have 17 active and 17 former? Because that's a complete, you know, shift in many of the things. And we have some theories, but I mean, they're just theories. It doesn't matter, but it actually does matter that and it is encouraging that some of these people are finding us and they're still active because they're really struggling and they just can no longer do it. And really the political climate, just as it's caused an exodus from the church, and especially evangelical world, a lot of pastors have, that's really been a big straw for them. They, you know, the straw that breaks it for them, because they are really struggling with that. They don't want to get up and preach leftist or rightist or whatever. And these congregations are kind of forcing their hands. So I've spoken to a few pastors that was the thing, and they were already struggling with their faith, but they really, that kind of put them over the top.
This was kind of directed by Catholic Notion, but I'm going to kind of expand it. Have you found that, like, you know, with like Catholics and maybe Jehovah's Witnesses and other people that have faced like the sex abuse and child abuse that has happened in some of these denominations, has like kind of, that was like their straw that broke the camel's back that kind of got them to contact you? Have you found that at all?
Applicants who have been abused in the church, is that what you're saying?
No, it could be that too, like both, but mostly like, you know, how the Catholic sex abuse scandal happened a couple decades ago, and then there's other denominations coming out with lawsuits and different things about the other abuse that's been going on in some of these different denominations. As any of the participants have you met that they said that this was like, you know, something they couldn't preach anymore and be a part of because of that?
I have not found that. I don't think that, I mean, that's okay. A whole separate, the whole pedophile scene certainly exists. It's well publicized in the Catholic Church, but it exists in all, you know, in all forms. I mean, you know, it's even secular, you know, the dirty uncle that, you know, you can't let
you
clear. So I don't think that's a rare thing. I don't see that affecting anybody coming in that has any effect on them.
Okay.
Got it.
I know this has gone long, but I'm a former pastor. I didn't get a chance, and I don't want to start crying again, but I do have to give a monster shout out to my wife. Because, you know, she's put up with a lot.
Aww.
And she's suffered a lot. And our family has. and she's had to watch that. And she's stuck by my side and I've stuck by her side. And I just wanted to make sure, because I think she's on the screen somewhere. So 25 years here in a couple weeks. Yeah. And that's what I consider the biggest success, because I really didn't think that we would make that. So I thank her and I thank my kids, because they've had to watch mom and dad struggle. And you know, we're not fully out of the woods, but we're feeling a lot better. And I love you, babe. Thank you.
Yay, two wonderful supportive spouses and kids. And I'm glad that you have such a wonderful partner that is, you know, holding your hand and standing right by your side. We need more of that in the world.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Charles. It's so good to hear how we hear stories all the time about telling spouses or family members and they just walk away and they're shunned. But because their God, their belief is so much more important than the family. But in your case, you were lucky to have the family be the first and the priority. It's so cool. So cool to hear. Thank you. Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once-cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the Volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.